As I did my morning yoga at home a month before coming here on 23rd April, it occurred to me that I should change the title of my talk here today. So the new title is, "They Don't Kill Us Any Longer, Wittgenstein and the Tradition of Socratic Skepticism." The new title is a good title because it captures well what I would like to be able to share with you today, namely an argument to show that it is a sign and measure of our failure to realize and live up to the full potential of Socratic skeptical philosophy that so few people today want to kill us or even send us into exile. So that's what I'm driving at. And now let me sober up a bit. Or maybe too much. I think it's useful, even if hardly surprising to anyone here, to say that there are two main traditions in the reception of Wittgenstein's work in Anglophone philosophy. In one tradition, Wittgenstein is read as a philosopher whose ideas and arguments contribute to philosophy that can be described with the adjectives progressive, constructive, theoretical, argumentative, analytical, scientific, academic, or systematic. In the other tradition, Wittgenstein is read as a philosopher whose work needs also to be described with words such as therapeutic, grammatical, dialogic. Oh, this one moves. I did something. It comes closer. Text comes closer. Therapeutic, grammatical, dialogic, ordinary language, or moral philosophy. The latter tradition, I call it here, the therapeutic tradition in philosophy inspired by Wittgenstein is, I'm afraid, rather marginal in contemporary academic philosophy. We might say that this lack of appreciation should come as no surprise. Wittgenstein thought himself that most contemporary philosophers would not understand him or take interest in his work. Similarly, the founding father of the therapeutic tradition, Socrates, said that there will always be very few who think like he does, based on the Cretan. Nevertheless, I think it may be a mistake to take the fact that the therapeutic tradition is marginal in intellectual culture, especially in philosophy, as a matter of course. If we do so, we may fail to see and acknowledge that the therapeutic tradition may itself be responsible for its marginal role. It has claimed, the therapeutic tradition has claimed, with good argument, as it seems to me, intellectual advantages. But as I suspect, and shall try to explain, that's my thesis, it has done so in a way that has not sufficiently attended to the moral sources that inform and sustain the positions and trends it criticizes. When its agenda has been curtailed in this way, the intrinsic moral and political challenge to what philosophy and reason is, and to what it is to live with reason, that lies at the core of the Socrates-Wittgenstein tradition, has become marginal and obscure. When this happens, the therapeutic tradition looks like one offering on the marketplace of intellectual fashions, among others, and whatever is unique to it may get lost. So that's kind of preamble. Now I give a list of topics, which is in the handout. It has 8 points. Point one, mystification of the distinction between the everyday and the philosophical. Point two, mystification of the distinction between the conceptual and the empirical. Point three, mystification of the difference between solving problems and dissolving problems. Point four, lack of responsibility for unintended consequences. Point five, shallow grip on the relation between Wittgenstein and the history of philosophy. Point six, narrow, other-directed, and self-congratulatory self-understanding. Point seven, failure to attend sufficiently to the unity of style, especially the polyphonic composition of the PI part one and its content. And eight, short-sightedness in the understanding of the question of critical standards. Now this list indicates, as is obvious, where I would like to locate the sources of the failure of the therapeutic tradition to live up to its full potential. In my discussion today, I will focus on number eight in my list. But I want to give one word on history before I go, namely number five. I think, and this is stuff I've written on elsewhere. I think it's useful to say that Wittgenstein belongs to a tradition of Socratic or a tradition of searching skepticism that is as different from what we may call doubting or negative skepticism as it is from the dogmatic or assertive philosophy that doubting skeptics criticize. The founding father of searching skepticism is, in my books, Socrates, the first philosopher to make explicit the distinction between searching and doubting skepticism is Sextus. So to me, I just announced that. I've written it elsewhere, I won't develop it. But to me, there's something of importance in the idea that we can see Wittgenstein as standing in continuity with the Sextian searching skepticism, and not so much with the doubting skepticism of the kind which has been more attended to in modern philosophy. Then to number eight, the question of critical standards. Let me provide some conceptual and historical context first. If I say that because of so and so happened, or if I say that A is better than B, or that X is the case and Y is not the case, we may ask for my reasons or grounds to do so, and for the validity of those grounds. Philosophers have, since Greece, been busy in particular with investigating the validity question. They have asked first, what is a valid ground, and also, can we have or provide valid grounds? Often we say that there are two major camps in debates about foundations for claims to knowledge and understanding. One camp has been formed by philosophers who claim that they can and do provide standards that can legitimize, that they can legitimize, and that can secure the validity of at least some claims to knowledge or reason. The other camp has been formed by philosophers who claim that they can show that no such standards are possible, and that therefore no legitimate claims to knowledge are possible. Another crystallization of main themes in this debate is the so-called trilemma of Agrippa. According to it, whenever someone claims to offer a valid, irrefutable source of validation to claims of reason, we can show that the claim depends on unfounded assumption or on circular argumentation, or leads to infinite regress. In early modern times, the trilemma of Agrippa and the response to it by Sextus Empiricus played a huge formative role in intellectual culture in Europe, with Montaigne's essays as a high point. Arguably, the central role epistemology and the question thereof foundations has played in modern philosophy since the contributions by Descartes, Hume, and Kant can best be seen as a reaction to those early modern debates. Wittgenstein has often been seen as standing in continuity with this high modern epistemology-centered tradition of philosophy, and bringing perhaps a kink to this tradition. According to some interpretations of the later Wittgenstein, he radicalizes and realizes the Kantian transcendental project through a theory of meaning, according to which forms of life, human practices or grammar, are conditions for the possibility of meaning or defining of the realm of meaning. On some such interpretations, Wittgenstein's theory of meaning allows universal, irrefutably valid claims, lest you start speaking nonsense. On other interpretations, Wittgenstein's theory of meaning radicalizes and realizes the Kantian project and implies a kind of conventionalism or linguistic idealism, realizes and undermines the Kantian project and implies therefore a kind of conventionalism, linguistic idealism, or perhaps also relativism. Now the therapeutic tradition is critical of both these readings, this way of understanding Wittgenstein's continuity with the Kantian tradition, claiming rightly, as it seems to me, that all interpretations mentioned fail in overcoming the constellation in which the trilemma of Agrippa and the jigsaw between foundationalism and relativism repeat themselves. Therapeutic Wittgenstein tradition has suggested that it has something different to offer. The strategic problem for the therapeutic tradition is how to keep upright the claim that it offers a way of getting to understand something, or getting clear about the problem, or getting done with a question, i.e. how it can claim to achieve something within the realm of reason that is not vulnerable to Agrippa's trilemma. How can we, in therapeutic philosophy, claim any achievement in the realm of reason, be it an insight, or the dissolution of an illusion, or the overcoming of futile search, or arrival at a point or an understanding where our problems has been solved. How can we achieve that in a way that differs sufficiently from the claims of assertive philosophy, not to be vulnerable to skeptical doubt, but in a way that is also not vulnerable to the criticism that it is destructive of all assertion and paves the way to full-blooded doubting skepticism? The search for a satisfactory response to this kind of question is, it seems to me, one of the organizing themes in Avner Basi's recent book, When Words Are Called For. I'll speak about Avner Basi in the third person, what I have here. In the introduction to When Words Are Called For, Basi makes a number of pragmatic claims. He describes his ambition as that of alleviating philosophical entanglements. He thinks that this can be done by showing that philosophers run into problems when they think they mean things, use words meaningfully, but due to deviation from, quote, ordinary and normal uses of philosophers' words, let their words idle, end of quote. When this happens, philosophical discourse becomes, quote, ultimately nonsensical, end of quote. However, Basi, who is alert to the rapidity with which Agrippa can come back on the scene, as soon as we're the least bit inattentive, Basi immediately adds that, I quote, the appeal to ordinary normal use of words, in contrast with philosophical use, is not meant to prove all by itself that the stretch of discourse makes no sense, but rather to weaken the hold of the conviction that the philosophical stretch of discourse must make sense. And also, I quote, to ask those who take the stretch of philosophical discourse to make clear sense whether it really does generate a genuine philosophical question. When we leave the introduction of Basi's book behind, we find the following story. There is first a discussion showing that what Basi calls ordinary language philosophy, I speak here about therapeutic philosophy, roughly the same term, has often been dismissed too early. This step in the argument is meant to pave the way for reconsideration of the potential of ordinary language philosophy. This argument, Basi implements in three steps. First, he outlines what he calls the prevailing program of mainstream analytic philosophy, and we did some of that yesterday with us here. He then goes to a detailed exposition and criticism of some specific contributions to this program. Thirdly, Basi moves to a presentation and criticism of what he calls contextualist continuations of the prevailing program, also things which were touched upon yesterday by you. Once we focus on this, I find much of what Basi says about the state of art congenial, and I find much of his discussion welcome and convincing. The problems for me begin when I focus on the meta-narrative that accompanies the main discussion. When we focus on this, it seems to me striking that the back and forth between grand general claims and withdrawal of those claims that I suggest we meet in the introduction continues throughout the book. Now, to bring this out, I will provide a number of quotes. My first set of quotes in the handout brings out the assertive theorizing and generalizing tendency in Basi's book. I will read out just two of the quotes, and they are in the handout. One is from page 117, it's on the first page of the handout, and the second of the quotes. I read it. Whenever a question arises in the everyday that might seem to be the same or essentially the same as the theorist's purportedly purely semantic question, what competently answering it involves, and hence, in an important sense, what the question itself comes to, is inseparable from the point of the question. Italics are by me, when there's bold italics, the italics are by, it's italicized by Basi. So in the second quote, and this is on the second page of the handout, it's from page 187. We should rather begin with the question of how know that and its cognates may intelligibly be used and normally are used in different types of situations. This shift of orientation in philosophy is what ordinary language philosophy, as I understand it, is trying to effect. Should we allow it to take effect, we may find that the answer to the second question tells us all that we might reasonably have expected to find when we raised the first question, the theorist question. And we would not have given up the talk of truth and falsity. We would just need to keep it to its natural appropriate places. So the italics I have used to highlight the tendency that I see at work in Bice's book to make universal theoretical claims that stand in a problematic relation to the criticism in the book of such theoretical claims made by other philosophers. I will let the quotes mostly speak for themselves, but for clarity, here are some remarks on the question they invite and the kind of dialectics that might follow. When Bice writes that so-and-so is inseparable from the point of the question, we may ask, so, but what is the point? Or perhaps even more lethally, is there a point? A response might be, that question we can address by looking at the point of everyday questions competently raised. And the response to that, quite right. And when is a question an everyday question? And when is such a question raised competently? To this we might reply, there is a question of sense here. And we must do as Wittgenstein says, and begin with the distinction between sense and nonsense. To which the retort might be, all right then, so what distinction is this? If I agree with you to begin with this distinction, what have I agreed to? If problems follow, will you not allow that we may need to come back to this beginning and look at it afresh? Or consider the last words of the second quote that I gave you, where Bice says, I quote again the last part, we just need to keep it, the talk of truth and falsity, to its natural appropriate place. Now let me suggest some different problematic responses to this claim. First response, who is we here? How is the we identified? Second, what is natural? How can we tell, and who is to tell, when, with what authority, what is natural? Three, what is appropriate? How do we go about that question? What is the relation between the natural and the appropriate? Is the appeal to the natural the same as the appeal to the appropriate, or different from it? If they are different, what to do if they point in different directions? And so on. And number four, what work does that little word just do? Is it an entirely innocent word? Can we just eliminate it and nothing changes? Or is it rather exactly the word Bice needs in order to mark his distance from the kind of illegitimate theorizing he so aptly detects and undermines in the work of others? Is the word then a cause of confusion for Bice, a word that deludes him? Does it mislead him to think that he's not theorizing, that he's not insisting on anything general, that he's not pressing his points philosophically or anything like that, because he just reports. Reports on what? On what we do. But what do we do? So Bice's book would of course not be worth discussing much if the tendency I have just focused on were the heart of his book. It is not. There are numerous instances in the book where he arguably cuts the edge of the kind of critical worry I have just raised. I'll read out two quotes again from the second set of quotes. It's in the handout on the second page, page 124, a short one. This Bice, I am not saying that our answers to the theorist's question are merely arbitrary and reveal nothing about the concept under investigation. Italics are again by me. Second quote from Bice, again on the second page of the handout, at the bottom. Of course, nothing stops us from attempting to travel the highway when we do philosophy. The highway is not exactly closed to them. But As I've been arguing in this book, given what travelling on the side roads of everyday thinking and speech normally involves and requires, there's no reason to suppose that attempting to take the highway with our words would get us anywhere worth getting to. What we learn from these quotes, I'm going out to comment on the quotes, what we learn from these quotes is clear enough. Buss does not say that the theorists he criticizes are wrong. Here, he does not say that we cannot do what the theorist wants and tries to do. Hence, if we press him, Buss, on the kind of thing he says earlier in the quotes, in the earlier set of quotes, he also himself does not need to say that the kind of generalizing remark he also at times makes are true. Whenever we get that impression from what he says, he can always withdraw his claim or qualify it. The message that remains is this. Buss's claim is not that he can prove beyond reasonable doubt that the philosophical positions that he criticizes are mistaken. Nobody insists that he has established the validity of his own suggestions on unassailable terms. What then is his ambition? His stated ambition is to give reason that recommends ordinary language philosophy to us, that makes us see its merits and advantages over other approaches. But what are the advantages? To understand this better, I will want to bring in some more material to work on. And again, I begin with some quotes. But in this case, some more extensive discussion will follow. I don't say that we would need more discussion on the early papers. I think we would, but I'm more interested now in this, in what I go to. Now, these are quotes again on the handout, the third page, and I'll try to read all three out. People with different temperaments, basic attitudes, past experiences, and so forth, would be likely to disagree with each other about such matters, concerning whether what they know or reasonably take for granted gives the sufficient assurance that some further state of affairs obtains. And I see no reason to suppose that if they did, then necessarily, at most only one of them would be saying something true and correct. What fact or set of facts sufficiently ensures the obtaining of some other fact is not only a context-sensitive matter, but within reason also a matter of opinion. That's one quote, and again, italics are by me. Second quote, however, if it should turn out that there are certain substantive disagreements among us with respect to the questions that are proposed we ask, this would not undermine my proposed alternative to the prevailing program. Rather, it would indicate that we fundamentally disagree in our sense of what makes or has sense, of what sense, if any, different things make, and of how they make that sense. To the extent that we do disagree this fundamentally, we will not have the same concepts. And finally, last short quote, and here too there is, within reason, room for disagreement in which neither side is wrong. So now the work on these quotes that I propose. What we have here looks, at first, at least, like a balancing act. Buss tries to set the scores for himself between the two tendencies I have recorded before. The generalizing assertive tendency and its counterpart, the tendency to withdraw, commitment, or the doubting tendency in his work. Where he lands looks familiar enough. In Buss's world, we have both assurance and uncertainty, both reason and opinion, both confidence in what we say, and self-critical awareness that the confidence may later be lost. I will first explain abstractly, and then gradually with some more concreteness, why I think Buss's balancing act fails, or what kind of problems I have with this balancing act. When Buss writes that people with different temperaments would be likely to disagree with each other concerning whether what they know or reasonably take for granted is a sufficient assurance that some further state of affairs obtains, and that this is all right because of what sufficiently ensures the obtaining of some other fact is within reason also a matter of opinion, we may think of Wittgenstein's simile of the room that is closed and only one door is left open. Is it now within reason, a matter of opinion, to be freely decided on the basis of one's temperament whether the room is really closed or not. There is a question here, as Bas rightly points out in another passage that I also quoted, about the relation between disagreement and talking each other by, that we may consider in the light of the distinctions between having the same concepts and shared understanding of their sense, having the same concepts but divergent understanding of their sense, and having different concepts. These are three different things. But before I attempt this second step, I want to say a few words about temperament. As I read Bas, he is attracted by the notion that there can be points in our discussions where we would say that we disagree because of our different temperament, not because of anything to do with reason. I think that with this, Bas places himself in the good and large company today of humanist liberals in philosophy who in so many ways define themselves as committed to fallible universalism, quasi-transcendentalism, neo-pragmatism, what have you. But is the charm of such a tolerant liberalism in philosophy sustainable? I have my qualms about that. Now, the sustenance of the charm is problematic to the extent the idea is generalized. This idea that within reason we have this space for temperament. The more it is generalized, the more it gives rise to the worry that surely reason must have some role to play in setting limits to what disagreement is within reason and what is not within reason. If you say, no, not really, the definition of those limits may also within reason be a question of temperament. If you say that, I think Agrippa will come to you with right. On the other hand, if you claim no generality at all for the relevance of questions about temperament, why did you appeal to it in the first place? What philosophical work is done by the appeal? If you allow no space for the question of standards by which you assess temperaments, you will risk outright subjectivism. If you do allow space for that question, you're back to the question how to decide that issue without circularity or ungrounded assumption. So you're faced again with the trilemma of Agrippa. So that was my short remark about temperament. Now I go to the question of concepts. I think it's quite right that philosophical disputes over issues can often be understood well only if we see how they are also rooted in differences of concepts and their meaning, what to make of them, how to place them when they are called for. But that way of changing tack will not do away with the problem of validation. The question Agrippa will now raise is, case one, people understand these concepts differently, or case two, have different concepts, even if perhaps the same English, familiar English word. By what standard can we judge, what is the source of polarization for judging which concept or which understanding of concept that it is better or more rational to have? This round of discussion about concepts and their sense, and whether they make or have sense, and what standard to appeal to in such a discussion is, I suggest, philosophically no less challenging, no less immune to the trilemma of Agrippa than is discussion of knowledge and cognates. Now there would be, perhaps this would be the right place to bring in the claim I have that we shouldn't mystify the distinction of the everyday and the philosophical, but I don't have time for that, so I skip it. Overall, my sense is that Bas does not overcome the suspicion that his liberal humanism is just a thin mask. If we scratch it a little, a familiar Janus face will appear. On the one side of the face, we have an ultimately nihilistic doubting skepticism. On the other side, we have the ugly face of the dictator, the one whose every whim and his every preference for his right to exterminate the other is a question of temperament and argument together, and lies within reason. It's not by chance, it seems to me, that Bas at the very end of his book invites Heidegger as his co-witness to the idea that we can, at the end of all chains of reason, allow ourselves liberation from the task of rationally vindicating our views in metaphysics, because, I quote Bas from the last page of the book, the application of concepts, which alone, according to Kant, wins for us a shared world, itself takes place and is only possible in such a world. Now, this is a provocation. Reference to Heidegger are problematic, when philosophical strategies and identities are at stake. I do not say that we all become Nazis if we agree in philosophy bars or are impressed by Heidegger. But I do want to say that if we avail ourselves to the view that we have a shared world, by recourse plainly through a mention that unless we have a shared world, we could not apply concepts, then it should also be made clear that our appeal only works even for ourselves, as long as we don't acknowledge that at any moment we can be thrown back into issues we just raised about whether and in what sense we can validate our notion that we can apply and share concepts. With the above, I wanted to say that Barthes in the end fails on two counts. He gives too much space both to outright skepticism, that's with the appeal to temperament, and with his final appeal to a world we share, to ungrounded assertion. Now I want to distinguish between two perspectives of the kind of trouble Barthes faces. When we think of the one side of the James face, the face of the dictator, we think the mask is ugly and dangerous because it may stop us from drawing limits about right and wrong that we want to draw. We don't want to open the door for those possibilities as possibilities within reason because of what that may lead to in our lives with others. This we might call the volitional or the moral or the social motive for rejection of some of what Barthes says. When we think of the other side of the James face, the face of nihilism, we think the mask is ugly and dangerous because it takes away the meaning of life from us. This nihilism we fear because what it means for our life with ourselves. This we might call the existential motive for rejection of some of what Barthes says. But are the motives I just mentioned motives beyond reason, so that they are in a sense irrelevant to Barthes' arguments, considerations and lessons? Our question brings to mind a famous passages by Stanley Cavell, in which, and I won't do any interpretation of Cavell, I just use these references for my purposes. It brings to mind some passages by Cavell in which he speaks of how, no matter how careful we, the philosophers of the therapeutic tradition, are, and no matter how far we travel in disentanglement or dissolution of philosophical difficulty, we may suddenly stand face to face again with a sense of the groundlessness of everything. Face to face, that is, with the reality and truth of skepticism. Cavell sometimes says that there are moments when the assuredness that the best effort therapeutic philosophy can give slips away and we face groundlessness again. He says that these moments are terrifying. One point of my discussion in this section has been the claim that Barthes does not overcome the challenge from Cavell. Therefore, he cannot expect his discussion to be satisfying to anyone who is not happy to bow with Cavell to the truth of skepticism. Now, what happens when we bow, like Cavell suggests we do, to the truth of skepticism? What is it that we do? Is the mistake not to be happy with bowing like that? Is the mistake not to be happy with bowing like that? Is this the place where Cavell suggests we bow, the place where the philosophical craving for argumentative grounding really ought to remain silent? I think in the therapeutic tradition, people are inclined to say there is a choice here. We can stop with Barthes at a place, perhaps with a person like McDowell, at a place where we can say with right that philosophical difficulties have been dissolved. Or we can say with Cavell that Barthes stops just one step too early, and that as we take one step further, we will see that all the anxiety and uncertainty that Barthes had wanted to save us from is not to be defeated. In either case, we may announce satisfaction that our journey has come to an end. The journey we speak about is that of philosophy or of reason. The end point we claim is the last station where reason takes us. We say, this is what life looks like if we claim, or to the extent that we claim, life with reason. Here is the light reason could shed on our world and our life. Now, live with that if you can. Now, if I'm not happy with or in agreement with or satisfied by Barthes' way of ending his balancing act, because I think it's rather than creating a balance he falls both ways, nor with the idea that we get things right when we add to Barthes' sense of satisfaction our quasi-Cavellian sense that behind Bas's friendly humanist face and ugly genius face is always grinning at us, am I then leaving the realm of reason behind? Or is there something I can do with reason or within reason still? So that's the last part. Wittgenstein speaks about imaginability and asks whether there is, as we search for grounds and grounds for grounds, something we cannot do. The connection to our topics that I want to make is this. Bas and Cavell fall, as I say things, too much a victim to the pressure from the doubting skeptic who builds her claim to partnership in the discussion with us on her capacity to say always, this you cannot do, or you cannot overcome this doubt. Now, her claim to partnership with us is exactly mirrored by the philosopher of assertion who says, it is not imaginable that this does not hold, or this, you must admit, is unassailable. In both directions, Bas and Cavell have a lot to offer, but they go wrong in just one place. That is when, or rather how, they stop to conclude, at the end of life we see that life is terrifying, or at the end of philosophy we find a shared world. The inclusion of the word, when I said that they, I said that is when or rather how they stop, the inclusion of the word rather how is important. Because of the distinction I make between doubting and searching skepticism. From the point of view of a searching skeptic, it's always all right, as Socrates and Sextus knew well, to stop and say, this is the end, this is where my spade is turned. They may occasionally add, as Sextus does in his opening statement of Outlines of Pyrrhonism, or as Wittgenstein, echoing Sextus, echoing Socrates, does in the first paragraph of the PI, that is not explicit in the voice of another author, that this is how it seems to me now. This tiny addition that the searching skeptic provides, that Wittgenstein provides in the very first sentence of his comments to Augustine, and that Sextus has in the opening lines of Outlines of Pyrrhonism, this tiny addition that the searching skeptic provides to where and how of stopping, as compared with what Bas and Cavell can say about the stopping, gives us, it seems to me, two advantages as compared with what either Bas or Cavell can offer. It produces equidistance to doubting skepticism and assertive philosophy, rather than the mutual sense of both of them that Bas and Cavell go to bed with the enemy. It also produces an openness to companionship, to a shared friendly world with both the assertive philosopher and the doubting skeptic, rather than sense from both sides of challenge and competition. The equidistance that is produced with this move to assertive philosophy and to doubting skepticism is this. The distance to the assertive philosopher is measured by the weight you give to the suspicion that something interesting happens if she adds, and that is how it is, or that is how it seems to me now. The distance to the assertive philosopher is measured by the weight you give to the suspicion that something interesting happens if she adds, the assertive philosopher adds, and that is how it is, to your, that is how it seems to me now. The distance to the doubting skeptic is measured by the weight you give to the suspicion that something interesting happens if he adds, and look now at this, and you will see how fragile and irresponsible your achievement is to your, that is how it seems to me now. So that's equidistance. The more important advantage I claim from my searching skeptic, as compared with what therapeutic philosophy typically has brought to the table, is the friendship it allows across the board. And I'll try to say something about that. This is where I move to examples, and I think there will be time to at least present one. And I'll step back a bit and praise Bas again. One of the many fine things in Bas's book, When Words Are Called For, is his generous attitude to the theories he takes on. He discusses them on their terms, pressing their words to see what those who suggest these words will say in the light of what Bas says, that these words are called for. I suppose that Das would say, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, with Gordon Baker, that the real test of his success is that the theorists whose words he takes on will accept what he says is correct, as doing justice to their words, to the sense their words have, or the failure of them to make sense. Why is it that with all the care Bas takes to attend with justice to the words he takes on, and all the respect he shows for the theorists, that I have the suspicion that he will not succeed, that he will be rejected by the theorists he invites to the conversation. In his dissolution of theorist claims, I go to my diagnosis of that, that prediction, maybe an empirical prediction, or I think it's a smaller conceptual prediction. In the dissolution of the theorist claims, Bass over and over again discusses examples such that nothing important depends on our capacity to get where the theorist wants us to get. It is true that the examples are given by the theorists themselves, but the theorists don't provide their examples with the idea that the examples as such are important. The examples are provided in the spirit, but that by addressing these examples, we will equip ourselves with the tools we need to address other examples that are important. If we don't see this, we cannot see the moral energy that gives life to the examples Bass discusses. And only if we address the other with full respect and care for the sources of this energy, can we hope to understand him and satisfy him. Look now at the one drastic case Bass also discusses, in the case of the lies President Bush used to convince his own people and his allies about the need to go to war against Iraq. Bass had discussed it before. He writes, I give you a quote, we go back to President Bush. What is it, and this is the run-up to the Iraq war, the question of weapons of mass destruction. What is it exactly that we wish to know about George Bush? Bass assumes here that the war has not yet taken place, and it has not been established beyond any reasonable doubt that the other country did not, in fact, have weapons of mass destruction. Now, do we wish to know, Bass asks, whether he, Bush, has been lying to the people, or at any rate has grossly misrepresented the information he has? This is a good question, and we know at least in principle how one might go about trying to answer it. But this is clearly not the theorist's question. Do we wish to know whether the president has credible and strong enough indications, a good enough basis for his claims, that the other country has weapons of mass destruction, whether he's justified in telling us that it does? These are the sorts of questions on which Austin, one of Bass's heroes, would have us focus. And they may be answered, and normally are answered, at the level of what competence and reasonableness require, without evoking the assessment if there's a true and false application and know that. If the president's basis is inadequate or non-existent, then he definitely should not have told us that he knew the other country had weapons of mass destruction. He would also not be justified in going to war if the only or main reason for doing so is the alleged possession by that country of such weapons. Now, Bass is right that the case he considers is morally important, and also that the arguments it involves gives a very different kind of attention to and involves very different standards of valorization of the word knowledge and its cognates, as compared with the other cases he discussed that he derives from philosophical literature. The use of the word knowledge and its cognates in the morally important case from real life does not so deceive, say to say, this use of the word knowledge and its cognates that we have in the case of Bush. The morally important case from in real life does not so to say feed into the use of the word knowledge and its cognates in the morally unimportant cases constructed by theorists for their purposes. Bass's suggestion is that this asymmetry is typical, and his lesson is that because of this asymmetry between morally important cases and the morally inconsequential cases we find in philosophical literature, we can come to the conclusion that even though there may be something to learn about the meaning of knowledge and its cognates from theorist discussion, this something will not be important. So this how is the balancing act again. We learn something, but the something is not important. But I think this is because of a one-sided diet in the example. So I got another kind of example, and what to do with it. In the run-up to the elections that made George W. Bush president, the death penalty was a topic of debate. Bush had argued in favor of the death penalty on the ground that it has a deterrent effect. But the interviewers crashed down on Bush, informing him that empirical studies or scientific studies show are in complete agreement that in fact the death penalty has no such deterrent effect. Then what happened? Bush, this was a TV show, Bush looks straight into the camera and replies, in my heart I know that it has. Now it's of course risky to assume that this brief description of an isolated case suffice for our needs, but I take the risk. I assume that Bush, as he looked into the camera and said what he said, successfully explained himself, his honest conviction and his approach to power. Here, he told the Americans, is a man who is ready, if need be, to defend our innermost convictions against the unreliable and unnerving authority of science. It's no coincidence that this is the same man who said that in global climate politics, the American way of life is not up for negotiations. It is a man who consistently defends a way of life in which the link between evidence and claims to knowledge can and will, in important cases, be forged better by evidence from the heart than by evidence from reason to the extent science exemplifies reason. My reaction is, it's intolerable that we accept Bush's idea of the grammar of reason and knowledge. His grammar is not just a different grammar from the one we know from the Enlightenment heritage. It's an inferior, lousy, and dangerous grammar. Any philosophical perspective, how we may speak about knowledge and its cognates, is simply wrong if it does not allow us the right to say that the way Bush uses the word is simply wrong. Now, when I say this, it's my reaction. I do not imply that I have shown that Bush is wrong in his criticism of the theorist. What I want to say is that Bush has used a one-sided diet. His examples all give little reason to insist that we should be worried that something important happens when people differ over judgments concerning the grammar of knowledge. That is fine and helps us understand the senselessness or the falsity, if you wish, of the theorist's ambition. But to understand the same ambition, the theorist's ambition, we need also to understand its sense or its truth. The truth of the ambition inheres in all those cases when it is or becomes important for us that when different people legitimize their claims to knowledge by different standards, the standards and the concepts of knowledge tied to those standards are not just different. It's also the case, or it can be the case at least, or we need to investigate whether it is the case that one is better than the other. I'll take a different example. It would be nice with more examples, but I have this time for this second one. I'm happy to think that neuroscience will not show us what pain is. I mean this in the following sense. At present, I cannot imagine that I would say that neuroscientific studies could in normal cases give me or others authority to say when and if a person is in pain. I do not fancy, and cannot fancy, that I would look to results provided by some technical measurement device to find out whether I have pain, or whether I have fallen in love with my classmate, whether I am jealous of my younger colleague. Nor can I imagine that I would look to such results to find out something of the same kind about other people I know and who are in my proximity. I mean, I can imagine some things. I can imagine the case of pain, that I follow a curve on a screen to know when to give a boost of painkillers to my child who is isolated because of a contagious disease. So there's some room for maneuver here. But the basic case, I'm quite firm about. It is for this reason, or this kind of reason, that I would say that if someone says, well, you see, what pain really is something neuroscience can now tell us, or will be able to tell us in the near future, these people are using a different concept than the one we have now. They're not using the same concept, or they're wrong about the concept, they have a different concept. These are suggestions for debate. This is the kind of thing that has been debated in a rather well-known debate between Daniel Dennett and Peter Hacker about neuroscience. Dennett's main argument has been that it does not matter whether Hacker correctly describes what we today mean by pain, and infers from this correctly that we do not say that pain is in the mind or in the brain. Then his main argument has been that it doesn't matter whether Hacker is correct in the description of the present grammar. The important thing for Dennett is that as we learn more about us through neuroscience, we can learn that the concept of pain we want is not the concept whose grammar Hacker describes, whether right or wrong. The concept we now want is the concept that is in line with scientific progress and that allows us to say just what Hacker does not allow us to say. Now, even though I think both Hacker and Dennett are confused in the debate is one, I think, which we can probably only get into satisfying perspective if we allow high theorizing as one of our tools. Let me indicate the kind of grounds I have for suspecting that this is the case. I take moral concern about the right treatment of animals in industrial food production, at family farms, in laboratories, at home, in connection with fishing and hunting, and in other connections, to present a lot of practical and real moral challenges to us. I have a sore neurophysiologist friend who told me, as we discussed Dennett and Hacker, that one thing that motivates his research is the hope that his discipline, he's a real scientist, his discipline will add to our knowledge about the sentient capacities of animals, and that this will help us adjudicate objectively in the complex and difficult moral terrain of our relation to animals. My sense of it was that it would be wrong of me to dismiss my friend's sense of mission offhand. Maybe there is truth in what he says. My point for our discussion, because it's close soon, is the legitimacy of the question whether my friend's quest is nonsensical or not is one aspect of the legitimacy of the kind of theorism about knowledge and the mind that we may easily dismiss too early unless we attend carefully enough to the difficulty of knowing always what is ordinary and what is philosophical, or knowing how to tell conceptual change from conceptual progress. With these remarks, I have tried to give some content to my problematic suggestions, and I'll come back to that. And this is my closing. If we want mainstream analytical philosophers and many others to take therapeutic philosophy seriously as a legitimate and serious voice in the quest for enlightenment, one thing we need to do in therapeutic philosophy is to look with care not only at how mainstream philosophers alienate themselves from real concerns, but also how their endeavor stands in continuity with such concerns. So for therapeutic philosophy to demarginalize itself, it would need its leaders, I suggest, to engage with as much seriousness and energy in the search for the truth of mainstream theorizing as it has done in the search for the falsity of such theorizing. I want to underline finally that I don't imply that I think truth is a halfway thing. I don't imply that, for instance, when Hacker and Dennett have a debate and don't come to agreement, truth would be fine through a compromise. In philosophy, we don't search for compromise, we search for truth. I'm therefore also not saying that we will find truth in the motivation that my Zorner physiologist expressed. I only suggest that it's part of the duty of the searching skepticist that I think an uncompromising commitment to reason dooms us to, that we take this question and others like it seriously, and that we're ready to be surprised and perhaps transformed in our work on them. Thank you.